The next case is 96-229, State of Ohio versus Larry Reynolds. Justice Resnick is not participating in this case, and we're pleased to have Judge Dickinson move over from his chair for Justice Cook to Justice Resnick's chair. Ms. Berlusky. I think I did not pronounce your name correctly. Berlusky, right.
If res judicata does apply, do we even need to get to the issue of the retroactivity of the case at Gaines?
In this situation, you only have raised your kind of bar post-conviction limit. If the court has undertaken this, working in the papers of Gaines, have held that to prove a gun investigation, to the gun investigation, to prove the gun operable beyond the reasonable doubt, is the law that has always been the law, then under State v. Coons, the 9th Court of Appeals, had affirmed the trial court's decision against denial of post-conviction, but this one is too hard. And as this court stated in Senate, as well as the Montecalvo, that race judicata applies in all post-conviction relief. And in that situation, that's what this court addressed involuntary manslaughter and the underlying misdemeanor for post-conviction. So applying that doctrine and looking after the state of proof, which is an outside of under court opinion, that's exactly what we need to ask. However, assuming argument of the race judicata is not applicable, then a standard must be enunciated by this court. And the standard has been enunciated by the United States Supreme Court. First of all, in U.S. v. Johnson, the United States Supreme Court, in discussing Payton v. New York and the retroactive application of Payton v. New York, stated that retroactive applications in civil cases are different than in criminal cases. This was again confirmed in the where the court again stated civil remedies as far as retroactivity are different than criminal remedies. Then the court, the United States Court, set forth the following rule. A new rule for conduct in criminal prosecution is to apply retroactive state and federal cases to cases that are pending on direct review or are not yet final. This is the standard that was followed by State v. Paulson, a Ninth County district. In Paulson, the defendant entered the plea of guilty to aggravated robbery by the number of weapons and did not appeal any of the decision. However, did file a post-conviction remedy after this court's decision in Gaines v. Murphy. The court of appeals at that point stated that the standard in versus Kentucky controlled, and because the defendant did not file any appeals, the time and finality of the judgment was there. There was no remedy. If the absence of decision to file the court reached in State v. Coons, State v. Coons, the trial court also held that the record was applicable, that the judgment was final. However, the Ninth Appellate District felt the chosen to use race to as the remedy rather than applying the perfect standard. What is very important in this case, Your Honors, is that our State Court of Appeals in Ohio relied on the Founders v. Manhattan Court decision, which is a federal case. It was a habeas corpus remand case. There was an aggravated robbery and an investigation habeas corpus remand under Gaines v. Murphy. The Manhattan Court relied on civil retroactivity law in the Chief's decision, which definitely goes against the United States v. Johnson and definitely goes against Clinton v. Kentucky. Consequently, that is bad law.
The question of whether this is a PCR or something else, the appellee says that this is a motion to vacate an illegal sentence. Does a trial court have jurisdiction to consider vacating an illegal sentence?
It has the jurisdiction to vacate an illegal sentence, but not after the Court of Appeals has determined.
Okay. Now, if we're talking about a motion to vacate as opposed to a post-conviction relief, are we talking about law of the case instead of res judicata?
Apparently, there's no such thing as a motion to vacate.
You told me that the court had jurisdiction to vacate and deal with the sentence.
Under post-conviction, this was not filed pursuant to post-conviction.
This was filed under the same case number?
It's just filed as a motion to vacate. And they are, it's a motion to vacate. It's not a sentence. But there is nothing in the legislature or the legislature not provided to anybody in the trial court or the authority of the trial court to modify the sentence except by legislation and action. That would have to be post-conviction or shock probation.
Okay, if by some stretch of the imagination this is properly before the trial court and it's not a post-conviction relief, so it's part of the same case, so that law of the case applies rather than res judicata, is the standard different?
I have not seen a case that definitely addressed that particular issue, and it's not really an issue before this court because the Court of Appeals, the law of the case of the Court of Appeals in this situation, number one, they denied the argument. Number two, they affirmed the conviction.
But isn't there some line of reasoning that with law of the case, if the law is changed, that the law of the case doctrine can be disregarded?
The law of the case doctrine is a viable doctrine under Nolan, but it also, the law of the case also has to go within the standards of what a court of appeals can do, and that's remand, reverse.
Are you saying his choice for relief here is misplaced, that his choice of relief should have been post-conviction?
Definitely,
Is there a statute of limitations on post-conviction remedy?
There was not. There is now under Senate Bill 2. Now it's 180 days pending an appeal.
Had he filed in post-conviction, would he have prevailed?
The state would contend no, because at that point, res judicata would have applied.
Race judicata is that able to be used in some against someone when the law had not even existed when he was tried?
Yes, State versus Coons is a very good example out of the Marin County Court of Appeals.
So the man has, even though it may have the right ring to it, he is unable to avail himself of any justice, as far as he's concerned, in this ruling, correct?
I don't think I understand your question. I mean, you can't pay his corpus, Your Honor. I mean, that's not included. But that report supposed to be based on the higher court, those are pretty good standards as far as the modification of sentencing. And see, this is an important reason for this case, because under Senate Bill 2, we have many changes in the law. And they're going to be hypothetical. There's a one-year gun specification now, which potentially is going to come into this court for some reason or another, whether it's a hazard to the government or not. The Hague Court was under a post-conviction relief remedy, 180-day time limit. That eventually will come into this court. And there are other changes in the elements of some of the statute that there's been able to, that potentially will come into this court for interpretation.
So you're saying everything has to end sometime.
Right. And that's basically exactly what this court stated in the tradition long ago, that there has to be a finality of judgment, public policy deemed as necessary. And this court's a very adamant for his chief counsel. Therefore, under the case law, the issue of hearing, there are three ways we have to go. Number one, find that motion vacate is exactly that motion vacate process as well as the case. Secondly, that if it is post-conviction, the race to the trial is applied, and therefore the court appeals will not be dropped here. And thirdly, the idea of the trial race to the trial is not applicable, then appellant really
thank you, Ms. Belsky. Ms. Townsend.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Timmy Townsend. I'm an assistant state public defender.
distinction, I would say that's a true statement, counsel. Is there a distinction, though, where the claims sentencing error, illegality, arises from an issue that is a change in the decisional law after the conviction has become final?
No, I would argue that it's not different. And that's because the decisional law that we're talking about here is not a new rule, a new constitutional rule for criminal procedure. The line of cases the appellant is citing are concerned with that. Instead, the decisional law that we're talking about in this case is a substantive interpretation of when it applies jurisdiction of a substantive criminal statute. And those interpretations have always been held to be contiguous with the life of the statute.
What's that mean? Contiguous?
That the interpretation is the law, always has been the law.
Always has been the law.
Second date of the statute.
And so the argument or the position by the Court of Appeals is that this particular defendant didn't know what the law was. And yet, you know, I'm wondering what's your response to the position that this defendant, like the defendant, Mr. Gaines, had the same opportunity to raise as error the failure of the trial court to find, you know, that the gun was operable and didn't. And isn't that the premise we use for the concept of res judicata, the doctrine?
That is the premise. However, there are a few quirks to this case that shed a different light on the premise. One is that Mr. Reynolds did raise an effective counsel here in the Montague motion, in an application of the notice. And in that decision in 1993, the Court of Appeals said the claim was not available to him. He could not have predicted the case. Therefore, lifting the res judicata bar as to these parties.
But the standard for ineffective assistance, of course, as you well know, is something different. You know, even if someone missed a point, that does not rise to the level of ineffective assistance, right?
Yes, except that in this case, the court was not arguing that trial court's error did not rise to the level of ineffectiveness, but rather that counsel did not have the capability of predicting what the law. In its later decision in 1995, the one that's on appeal here today, the court explained that it, in its application for reopening, had denied the application for reopening because the claim wasn't available to Mr. Reynolds at the time of his direct appeal. It followed its earlier case in Jesse James Wilson, stating that the claim was not available.
Why wasn't it, though? Why wasn't it available? In theory, wasn't it exactly available to him as it was to Gaines, who raised it and prevailed?
In this district, however, Vasquez was a reported case controlling law stating that Monty Burns, deadly weapon standard, was the standard of review for firearms that operability could not be determined.
What if, in fact, he had raised it and lost? Would you still be here making the same argument?
He would have been in the same position as Mr. Seth Jeffries from Colorado. They actually litigated their claims that later were subjected.
But I thought the rule for res judicata was you litigated or you could have litigated it.
It is indeed. And what we're saying is that since the Court of Appeals in its 1993 decision, which was not appealed, stated that the claim couldn't have been raised.
Well, I don't think they said it could not have been raised. They
said it
was.
Right,
which means he was not ineffective.
Right.
He could have raised it. You have no doubt that he could have raised it. Sorry.
Truly, I do not have any doubt.
Okay.
In any instance, even assuming that he could have raised the issue, even assuming that the motion to vacate must be construed as a post-conviction petition.
Let me ask you, if it's construed as a PCR, you lose based upon Monte Carlo and the other case, don't you?
I would argue that I don't, because Zelchek and Monte Carlo are merely approving and following pair, and that there is a higher policy and interest in Larry Reynolds' case that outweighs the policy of finality that undergirds Perry and Zelchek. And that interest in Mr. Reynolds' case is that where it is conceded by the state and has been previously found by the Court of Appeals, then the trial court, then the Court of Appeals again, that there is no evidence on the record of operability, then Mr. Reynolds is factually innocent of this firearm specification. And it's a higher public interest to ensure that people are not punished for acts that the legislature has not prohibited than the interest of finality that is quoted in Zelchek. And that's why...
I don't understand. In those two cases, somebody was convicted of manslaughter based upon minor misdemeanors, and which proved that. How could the interest be greater in this case than in those?
Well, I'm not sure that the interest is greater. However, I can still distinguish Zelchek because in Zelchek, Zelchek revolves around this court's case of Safety Collins, which found that looking at the prior law on voluntary manslaughter, you could use a minor misdemeanor as a character offense. Shortly after Collins was decided, the Ohio General Assembly amended the statute, specifically including a minor misdemeanor as a predicate offense. In our case, since the incident had been decided, the General Assembly has not amended the firearm operability requirement whatsoever. Therefore, I would argue that Zelchek and Monte Carlo are really the court's backing off of an interpretation that did not comply with the intent of the legislature and Congress. And furthermore, that Zelchek was a case that had to be decided by this court in order to dispel the impression given by the summary ruling in Westfall that Perry was no longer the law. I would ask the court to look at the restatement of the law, second on judgment, section 26. This court has recently looked at the statement of final judgment, 3 years, I would ask that you adopt the exceptions to res judicata that are outlined there. That is, that where the judgment in the first action was plainly inconsistent with a statute or a constitutional scheme, res judicata should not be applied. And here, the firearm specification imposed on this court does not comply with the statutory requirements. Also violates the constitutional requirements that you can prove beyond reasonable doubt guilty that are known in the defense. And furthermore, that the second exception in the restatement, that policies favoring finality are overcome for an extraordinary reason, such as the invalidity of continuing restraint on liberty. Once again, here I would argue that Mr. Reynolds is conceivably factually innocent of this firearm specification. Zelchek didn't argue the constitutional implications of his case. Mr. Reynolds has argued these questions from the beginning, and that's another reason why this court should distinguish this case from Zelchek. The application of res judicata in this case would be unjust, and I would refer you to your opinion in Meridian. I would like now to switch gears a bit and address the retroactivity question of Comey's authority. This court in State versus Humphreys has already held that interpretation of a criminal statute is retroactive to the date of the statute. I don't know why appellant continues to refuse to acknowledge that case. However, that case is out there, and that is why Sanders versus McMaffin was decided.
What about Griffiths versus Kentucky?
Under Griffiths versus Kentucky, once again, that's the retroactivity rule for cases involving judge-made constitutional rules of criminal procedure, not involving interpretations of criminal substantive statutes.
you say that the case makes that distinction? Or you're making the distinction?
I'm making that distinction. Right. And there are other cases that do make that distinction. For example, Rivers versus Railway Express and the United States Supreme Court, which is cited in U.S. versus McKee. There, U.S. versus McKee is concerning a federal criminal statute. And they're saying we don't have to follow the Teague versus Lane, basically, because a judicial construction of a statute is an authoritative statement of what the statute meant before as well as after the decision of the case interpreting that statute. However, even if you adopt appellant's rule in Griffith versus Kentucky, Gaines still is retroactive to Mr. Reynolds' case because Mr. Reynolds' case was not final when Gaines was decided. That's one reason why Mr. Reynolds filed the application for reopening based on an effective appellate counsel. Gaines was decided on October 11, 1989, and Mr. Reynolds' time to appeal to the Ohio Supreme Court for his Court of Appeals decision affirming his conviction expired on October 30, 1989. Therefore, his case was not yet final at the time Gaines was decided. Gaines applies to this case even though he was not being indicted. However, look at the latest result that you get from applying the written rule to interpretation of the subsequent statute, because Murphy, which limits Gaines, would not apply in this Reynolds case, though Gaines would, where he was decided in March 2019.
Isn't that a double-edged sword, that argument you're making now, that it wasn't final? That, in fact, your client was even in a better position because the case was out there, Gaines was already out there?
And that's exactly why he filed the application for reopening. It wasn't available while, you know, during briefing or argument or the decision, but indeed, he could have cited Gaines if he had gone on to appeal to the Ohio Supreme Court. Gaines came out too late for a timely motion for reconsideration of the Court of Appeals, which we know is 10 days. So he couldn't have done anything there. However, Mr. Reynolds didn't have counsel for an appeal to the Ohio Supreme Court, which is why he didn't appeal to save him. He was an indigent. But that is the very reason why the application for reopening was filed by this office, because appellate counsel was ineffective for failing to save Gaines. Now, however, once the Court of Appeals said, okay, we're saying Gaines versus Murphy, Gaines and Murphy are retroactive, and we're basing that on State versus Humphreys, that found the State versus Robertson was retroactive, and we're basing that on the University versus McMenamin. And they further said that there's no evidence on this record of operability, and further that counsel could not have predicted Gaines. That then Mr. Reynolds relied on those necessary findings in his motion to vacate in the trial court. And therefore, one of our arguments throughout this court has been that the state is stopped from relitigating the issues of retroactivity, res judicata, and sufficiency of the evidence because there was no appeal taken. And the Court of Appeals 1993 denial of application for reopening serves as a valid final judgment on all the issues that were necessarily decided between these parties.
You've used your time.
Thank you.
Ms. Brilski, you've saved a little over a minute and a half of your time.
I will be brief. First of all,